we've looked at a number of different aspects of the Middle Ages, let me point out that by the 13th century, France was the richest and the most powerful single kingdom in all of Western Europe. The kings of France had managed to extend their holdings. Indeed, by the 13th century, they had managed to take Normandy away from the British, and all that the British kings possessed in France was the southwest portion, the old inheritance from Eleanor, which is now called Guienne. And the French kings had managed to centralize a good deal of strength and power. It is notable that throughout Europe, up until the mid-14th century, there is a constant population explosion going on. New lands are being opened up to cultivation. Hillsides are being terraced. And there is increasing wealth going on throughout Europe. Then, in the mid-14th century, disaster strikes Western Europe. It strikes because there had been a very considerable trade with the East now for a very long time. And along with the other things that they brought back intentionally from the East, they also brought back on the ships increasingly large numbers of black rats. And in the year 1348, a ship arrived from Constantinople and from the Crimea, part of its cargo, and with it, it brought not only rats, but rats who were infested with fleas who carried the bubonic plague. Now, this type of flea lives off the black rat by preference, but when there aren't enough black rats around, it also is willing to leap onto human beings and feed there for a while, and this brings the plague. Now, the plague struck first up around Genoa, arriving there, and it began to spread very rapidly through Italy, through France, and then on. This is the famous Black Death, and it spread throughout Europe in the years of 1348, 1349, 1350. It sweeps through most of Europe, going up through France into the Germanies, to England, and then sweeping across the northern part of Europe, heading now to the east. It also gets down into Spain, it goes through Italy, and the Balkans. The result of this in this period is that approximately, and we don't have accurate numbers, one-third of the population of Western Europe died of this plague. Some parts were just totally, villages disappeared completely. Some cities suffered enormously. Notable, for instance, that Florence loses a good third of its population, and a city such as Siena, which had been a great trading city, was not to recover its population of the age of 1348 until the 20th century. It hit very strongly in parts of France. Now, this was, of course, a disaster from which Europe would recover only very, very slowly. It's notable that the population of Europe does not reach the level of 1348 again for almost 200 years. It takes that long to regain that population loss. Now, needless to say, the Black Death was not in this time understood. People did not know much about plagues. They didn't know what caused them. They didn't know what to do about them. So you had various responses to this. The people who could tended to flee the cities and to go out to country estates. Indeed, Boccaccio's famous book, The Decameron, is written about a group of Florentines who fled the plague to a villa, and they regaled each other by telling stories day after day while waiting to see if the plague will strike them as well. Some people decided that since they were probably going to die anyway, the best thing to do would be live it up in grand style. A group of rich young boys down in San Gimignano were famous for doing that. Lots of others, of course, went to churches. So there is something of a religious revival that goes with it. And shortly after the plague ceased, of course, what you had it followed by was famine. because there had been great losses in the countryside as well as the cities. And then people from the countryside seeking food moved into the depopulated cities. So it's disaster piled on disaster. What's more, the plague once in Europe remained endemic in Europe for centuries, which means simply that periodically it would appear again in one place or another. Now, it never is going to strike as deadly a blow as it did in the famous Black Death. But nonetheless, there are recurrent plagues through the 15th century, through the 16th century. In the 17th century, the Great Plague of London is another recurrence of the bubonic plague. In other words, there are a whole series of things. Yes?
Were the Jews also blamed for
it? Oh, everyone is blamed for it. The Jews, yes, in part. But in times of disaster, yes, groups like this are apt to be blamed. At the same time, of course, it struck in areas where there were no Jews and they couldn't be blamed. In England, for instance, the Jews had been deported from England in the 13th century. The late 12th century. But nonetheless, it's true that Jews were accused of this among all kinds of other things. So that this plague made for a lot of changes. Indeed, one of the things that happened with this, for instance in England, was that lands that were depopulated left landowners in the countryside with big manors and not enough persons to till the fields. So what they began to do now was to simply enclose what had been common lands and turn them out to pasture. Now this is the beginning of the so-called enclosure system, which will go on slowly in England right up into the 18th century. But it starts now, particularly in East Anglia, and they start raising sheep instead. Now sheep, of course, are valuable primarily for their wool, not as food in this particular period. And the wool trade became a source of enormous wealth. The wool was primarily exported to the Netherlands, where it was sold to the great weavers and the weaving towns there. But there were dislocations, and it meant that there was a considerable now dissatisfaction with some of the elements of feudalism, which were beginning to run thin by this time. With the growth of towns, feudal dues, exactions, taxes, and so on, no longer began to seem as reasonable as they once had been. And the result is that there is a flurry of peasant revolts that occur in the later 14th century. One of the most famous is the revolt of 1381 in England, where you had groups of peasants, mainly from East Anglia, in other words, the exact area where enclosures had been taking place, and from Kent, who converged on London. Now, what they wanted was to have feudal taxation changed. They wanted jobs, because there was a good deal of labor, cheap labor, simply on the roads trying to survive by now in England. And they managed to seize part of London itself in 1381. It is one of the first appearances of a major peasant revolt and also of a kind of incipient democracy, because there were traveling poor preachers with this, including one named John Ball, and the favorite ditty that he preached on was, "When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman?" So that you have a beginning of some thought of this line this early. It's going to take a long time to get very far, but this is the first note being struck. All right, now when the rebels seized parts of London, they seized the Tower of London, and among other persons, they seized the Archbishop of Canterbury and dragged him out to Tower Hill and beheaded him there. They blamed him for a good deal of the taxation. He was also a government figure. Indeed, the chronicles on this are rather dazzling. They point out that not only was his appearance greeted by a cry like that of a diabolical peacock from the crowd, but that after he had been beheaded, a miracle took place very promptly. This is still an age when miracles take place, and this one is rather a nice one, because a woman went up that night to the body to pray for the murdered archbishop to help her, because she had been trying to give birth to a child for 2 years. And lo and come hold, she promptly gave birth to the child. It was a son, and it was baptized. I assume it walked out talking by that time. But at least the Chronicles tend to run in this way, which is sometimes why we're not sure the Chronicles are precisely good history, however entertaining they may be as reading. Nonetheless, the revolt was put down very sharply. The leader of the revolt, Wat Tyler, was killed in a meeting with the young king, and the rebels were put down. Peasant revolts of this period are none of them going to be successful. But it is a good sign of the enormous kind of social and economic unrest that appears after the Black Death in Europe. This is the age called the Late Middle Ages. Now, there's another rather dreadful phenomenon that strikes in this period. It is the thing called the Hundred Years' War. Now, that's an odd name, because the war starts in 1337 and ends, in fact, in 1453 or 4. So it's more than 100 years. And what's more, there are long periods in that in which the war isn't being fought at all. There are three main periods in the fighting of the Hundred Years' War. And the war takes place between England and France. It is involved in the first case with a very shaky English claim to the French crown. This would be through marriages and through the female line. And the French immediately insisted that there was an old law which said that the kingdom of France could go only to a man, never to a woman, nor could the inheritance be passed through a woman to a son. So-called Salic law, which they insisted goes back in Frankish history, but which in actual fact was one that they made up on the spur of the moment to deal with this particular case. Under any circumstances, by the time Edward III came along, his claim to the throne of France was no longer any good at all. Nonetheless, he attacked France, and he did succeed in capturing the port city of Calais. Now, this meant that the English were going to have a kind of good port that they could shuttle troops to for the wars in France, and they were to maintain this. They had also managed very quickly to defeat the French fleet, so that this was out of the picture, and they had access to France. I must, I think, make it clear to you that this kind of war is a summertime war. Wars are not fought in the winter at all. It simply means that you have yearly expeditions that go over and fight in the summertime, and that this is what it's about. What they can do is ravage fields, perhaps occasionally take a town, but not too often, and create general misery and trouble, something the knights tended to enjoy and no one else enjoyed. This eventually culminates, in fact, 10 years after the date of the beginning of the war, in a very famous battle at Crecy, C-R-E-C-Y. This is a battle in which the English are, in fact, largely outnumbered by French troops. But the English had a chance to take up a position along the top of a small hill or ridge. And the English by this time were using a weapon the French were not using. The French still relied on the heavy armed knight as the main core of the army. The British had already, in their wars with Scotland, developed the longbow as a weapon. Now, the longbow is a far more efficient weapon than is a crossbow. A crossbow is only a good weapon at 100 yards or less, and it's a bow that has to be cranked up and fired. A long bow is a very long kind of bow. It is fired with enormous strength, and it can be used with accuracy over 300 yards and more, so that it was efficient at greater range And, of course, it could be fired with vastly more rapidity. Now, the English stationed groups of infantry armed with a longbow on either side of the body of mounted knights in the center. And the French had rather stupidly stayed at the bottom of the hill while they got in position. When the French did charge, of course, what happened was that the bowmen simply cut the French down in enormous numbers. It is a spectacular French defeat and a major, major English victory. Now, this is going to mark the beginning of a return of infantry for use in armor, and is going to very slowly begin to displace the armed knight as the core of the army itself. This is going to be of some importance, let me point out to you, because, of course, the infantry is not made up of knights or figures from the upper classes. These are going to depend on free yeoman, that is, in other words, on a free peasantry. And again, it will move a new class into a position of greater importance than it had held before. It's part of this social change. And indeed, while the Black Death does temporarily put the Hundred Years' War out of commission, by 10 years later, that is in 1357, the English are back with another major army. And it seems incredible, but exactly the same thing happens. The French have not learned about the longbow. All they have got in their minds is the fact that it isn't useful to fight on horses against it, because you shoot the horses out from under the knights, and it's very hard for you in full armor to struggle up on your feet very effectively. So in this case, the French dismounted their heavy armed knights to slog up a hill through the mud against the British. The slaughter was enormous. There were three times as many French as there were English, and the French killed off, indeed, the flower of French chivalry in that one battle. They even captured the King of France himself, King John, and took him over prisoner to England, and he was eventually ransomed from them. So that the French, indeed, were to learn for a while that this was not a good way to fight a battle. Now, this is followed, indeed, by a period in the last part of the 14th century in which the French changed their tactics. Now they were under a brilliant leader, a constable named de Gascoigne, and he followed the policy of simply not facing the British in major battles anymore, letting the British ravage around and at the end of the summer go home. Then he went down with his troops into English territory, Guienne, and simply took over towns that he could hold and managed to capture back to France very much of southwestern France. Indeed, Port of Bordeaux and a few other areas were about all that was left to the British by the year 1400. Now, it looked, of course, at this point, as though the British were out of the picture entirely. What's more, there had been a change in ruling house in England. The House of Lancaster had come in with Henry IV. But in 1415, the Hundred Years' War revved up again, rather surprising, when young Henry V of England decided to pursue a claim again against France. Indeed, again, there was a claim. It was in part based on the fact that the French king had gone mad, and his widow, or his wife indeed, Isabel of Bavaria. Isabel of Bavaria is actually not a very nice woman. She is one of the few first-class bitches in the willing to be paid off and to proclaim, in fact, that her son and the heir to the throne was bastard, and to further the English claim. Now, the English were able to side this time with the House of Burgundy, and I'll get to the House of Burgundy in due time. But they invaded, again, under young Henry V, splendidly, in 1415. Now, here, astonishingly enough, the French had learned nothing from Du Guesclin nothing from Crécy, nothing from Poitiers at all. They again fell into the same stupid booby trap. People should study history once in a while. It has uses. And the French should have studied it now, because they put heavy armed knights right back against the archers at Agincourt, and they were cut to ribbons. So this was an enormous now British victory, and the British proceeded to capitalize on this in most spectacular ways, and with the aid of the House of Bourbon. What they succeeded in doing, in fact, was in moving straight across northern France. They took back all of Normandy. They eventually were to capture the capital city of Paris itself, and well to the east of Paris. They owned the territory straight down and recaptured all of the southwest and the territory between. Indeed, the young French king, this is Charles the VI, was driven out of his city down into the Loire Valley, where he was scornfully referred to as the King of Bourges, because all he held were a few castles and towns in the Loire Valley. Henry V married a French princess, Catherine, and actually that's not a wise marriage. He was to bring the taint of madness to that marriage, and so that Henry V's son, Henry VI, was also to be mad for considerable periods in his life. Henry V died when his son was a minor. It did not upset the war. The English were still ruled now by a regent, the Duke of Beaufort, and he held Paris in great court and continued these wars. Indeed, the English army was down in the Loire Valley eventually, laying siege to the important city of Orléans, when one of those lovely, unexpected things in history occurred. The French king was cowering in his castle with his friends and knights when a young girl appeared, a French peasant girl, from Domremy. She announced her name was Joan, and she came from the village of Arc, and she had been sent. Voices had spoken to her, the saints had come to visit her, had told her that she must go to the rescue of her king, and that she must have him properly given a coronation in the coronation cathedral at Reims. So she arrived all by herself to announce this to the king. Now indeed, the king eventually received her, and he carefully stood to one side, so that she wouldn't know who he was, and a richly dressed friend of his stood in the position of honor. That didn't fool Joan for a minute. She went right straight to the king and said, "Sire, I need a horse and I need armor, and I'm going to lead your troops to victory." Well, what can you lose? Crazy. So they gave her a white horse and they gave her armor, and they sent her out with French troops to relieve the siege of Orléans. And she beat the socks off the English, drove them right straight away from Orléans, drove them right out of central France entirely. It was astonishing. But the French picked up heart from all of this, and Joan was totally successful in leading her troops now, and she did manage to take back the cathedral city of Rennes, and she did manage, in fact, to see that her king had a proper coronation there, and was crowned as King of France. She then, of course, continued the battles against the English and was betrayed into the hands of the English. She was taken prisoner and was tried in the city of Rouen in Normandy, withheld by the English. It was an ugly trial. She was accused, of course, of being a witch, and she was accused of lying, that she had not heard voices of saints. This was the devil speaking to her. She was put to the torture again and again, and tortured to the point that she would confess. But when the torture was over, she always said this was not true. It had been forced from her under duress. She never gave up faith in her saints and in her cause. So she was finally burned alive as a witch in Rouen. Now, her French king did absolutely nothing to help her in this entire time. He
He did not try to move to attack Rouen. He did not try to get her out in any way at all. He is something of a loss. But Joan died there. And the French continued, however, to fight. And indeed, after Joan's death, the French were to be continually successful until finally, by 1453, the British are driven out of Bordeaux, and by 1454, all of that territory is in the hands of the French. It means that the British now were driven completely out of France, and that almost all of what we consider France to be today is under the control of the French king. Brittany does not belong to them yet, nor does Burgundy, as yet, but they will get those very shortly. So the Hundred Years' War is to end in a victory for France. Eventually, it is quite true that the French king did get around to having Joan's trial reviewed and rejected. And indeed, he was able to force through that the papacy itself came out of this and declared that Joan was for real, that Joan was not a witch, so that that charge was dropped. This did not make Joan of Arc a saint. Joan is going to have a long, long road to hoe before she will become a saint. Joan did not become a saint until after she has won a major victory in World War I, when she appeared miraculously in the sky at the Battle of Mons in World War I, and the French troops rallied to that vision, and it is not until the 1920s that Joan of Arc becomes Saint Joan. That always surprises people, indeed, because we have a tendency to feel she must always have been a saint. Not at all. She's one of the very new ones. And you must admit, having to win World War I in addition is really making it tough. But it's notable that she succeeds also. So the Hundred Years' War, as a whole, managed to keep France in a series of turmoil. It is in part due to this that France loses, for this time, its position of being the paramount cultural center of Europe. Indeed, France is unable to maintain what it had held in the 13th and the early 14th century, so that the position of being the cultural center is going to move elsewhere. England, indeed, will continue to be involved in wars. Now civil wars in England itself between the House of York and Lancaster, and that will not be resolved until 1483 when the House of Tudor takes over the English crown. Now I've mentioned the Burgundians several times, and they need to be brought into the picture here. This goes back to, in fact, that French king who had been taken prisoner, King John, in the Hundred Years' War. When King John was ransomed and returned to France, what he did was to give some large territories in France to members of his family, brothers. And one brother was given the territory of the Duchy of Burgundy. Now, this is a territory in France that lies on the eastern part of France. And along with this went the County of Burgundy. Now, the County of Burgundy, some of you may know, as a French province called Franche-Comté. It lay outside of France proper and was technically a part of the Holy Roman Empire. In other words, it lies between the province of Burgundy and France and Switzerland. None of this was... That was not extraordinarily a rich country, but to have that marriage broken off and to ensure that his brother was married to the heiress of Flanders. Now, Flanders is an enormously wealthy country. This was the center of the great wool trade. This was one of the places where cities first grew up, and it meant that the Dukes of Burgundy now, in fact, own a section over towards Switzerland and the Netherlands. What's more, these new Dukes of Burgundy, with this enormous new wealth that came to them from the Flemish heritage, became extremely ambitious. They are good at marriage. The very next one down the line marries into the imperial family, and his wife brings him a whole swatch more territory, Luxembourg, areas that we would call Holland today, and territories that begin to move over toward Burgundy. Now, this is what gives the Dukes of Burgundy the passionate plan that they are going to pursue for several generations. And this is a desire to recreate the lost Middle Kingdom. Remember that that Middle Kingdom had existed between France and Germany with Lothar, and now, indeed, they tried to gain all the land in between that would join Burgundy to the Netherlands. Finally, indeed, they lack only bits of Alsace and Lorraine. There's a consistent pressure here through war and through marriages, at which they were notoriously good. Now, what happened while this was going on was that the Dukes of Burgundy, having all of this wealth and power and trying now for an independent kingship, fell foul of their relatives in France. One of them falls foul of a nephew, because when the King of France is a minor, both of them want to be regents. So it establishes two parties, the House of Orléans against the House of Burgundy. And they begin, indeed, to do rather unpleasant things like arranging assassinations back and forth, which increase the tensions between them. Now, this is the reason why Burgundy is willing to join with England in that last period of the Hundred Years' War. They have economic interests in common, and Burgundy is, of course, now at war against the House of Orléans. So that this is what made for that particular change. Eventually, after Joan appears on the scene and the English begin to lose, Burgundy will haul back out of that coalition and will, in fact, join with France. What happens to the House of Burgundy basically is this. You have a series of good and extremely rich dukes, and the last Duke of Burgundy in the 15th century is a man called, depending on how you translate the French word, either Charles the Bold or Charles the Rash. Either one of those will do. But certainly, he is determined now to gain the last of the territory that would give him a united area, that is in Alsace and Lorraine. He is using Swiss troops, and the French king, in fact, hires Swiss mercenaries to fight against him. And Charles the Rash is killed in a great battle. Now, he leaves, in fact, only a daughter, Mary of Burgundy, and she is heiress to this enormous estate. The French king at the time is named Louis the 11th, and Louis the 11th makes a fast grab for the Duchy of Burgundy as being in French territory, and also for the County of Flanders, or Parma. And this so terrifies Mary that what Mary does is to immediately become betrothed and married to a Habsburg, the Holy Roman Emperor, Maximilian. Now, this will bring all of her other rich territories, the Netherlands, into the house of the Habsburgs, who from this time on will be the deadly enemies of France. So that Burgundian possession again revives something of this concept of a Middle Kingdom. It's the second time that this plays a major role in history, and it is going, of course, to continue to play exactly this kind of a role, because this will be the territory fought over between France and Germany in 1870 and 1914 and on down in history. It plays a continuing long role there. So the House of Burgundy is of some splendor, and it goes along with the high point of the first period of the so-called Northern Renaissance. And indeed, that will center in the Netherlands and under the House of Burgundy. We're going after this to have to look at the Italian Renaissance before we return to the north, and it is notable that Italy can take over as the new cultural and intellectual center simply because of the long series of problems that have been fretting the rich countries of France, England, areas like this. Now, there is one other thing I want to bring up today because it has disturbed me. After the last lecture, one of the students in this class came up and explained to me that I had been deeply offensive to a number and a considerable number of students in this class. I don't know how many, and this disturbed me because I have no desire to be offensive to students in this or any other class. The grounds for this were that I had been using the terms Christ and Jesus interchangeably in that lecture and in other lectures. And it was pointed out to me that indeed, by proper Jewish theology, Jesus is his first name and he is not Christ. Now, indeed, I knew this. And in fact, in Mohammedan theology, Jesus is not Christ either. He is the next to the last of the prophets. However, of course, in Christian theology, Jesus is the Christ. And what is more, this is the essential point in Christian theology. It is the reason why it is called Christianity. And I assumed, in fact, that all of my students would understand when I used it this way, that it was being used, in fact, correctly in terms of Christian belief. And I was, after all, lecturing on Christian topics in a deeply Christian period of the Middle Ages. I believe very, very firmly that tolerance and understanding and respect for other religions and other people is vitally necessary in today's age. We cannot possibly hope to survive without this. It is absolutely essential. So that I have no desire to give offense to any of you on any of these grounds ever. And if I use this kind of language, I want you to understand the format within which I use it and try not to take offense at this. But I also believe just as deeply that tolerance and respect are a two-way road. And I do think in the long run that Christians too deserve a little respect and tolerance and judgment and indeed charity if necessary as well. So I will continue to use this and I hope none of you will take offense and I hope I have explained this. If any of you want to discuss it with me afterward, please feel free to come up and talk to me about it.